Sinners hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from the fear of one in authority? Then do what is right, and you'll be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it's necessary to submit to authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for authorities are God's servants to give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be are summed up in this one command, to love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. I'm going to stop there. And there's a lot in this passage, and to be frank, we're probably not going to be able to unpack all of it as I might like to. But I want to begin by talking about that word authority that Paul uses at the very start of this chapter. And I mention it because those verses stick in my throat a little bit. That idea of accepting or not resisting authority, not rebelling, submitting to the people in charge and paying taxes, being a good law-abiding citizen. It makes me squirm a little bit. Not because I'm some kind of die-hard rebel who wants to stick the middle finger to the law at every conceivable opportunity, although my wife will tell you I don't like being told what to do. It makes me squirm because of a question of injustice, particularly what do we do if we witness injustice and it's being perpetrated by the people in charge? And that feels particularly pertinent at this time when we have things like the Extinction Rebellion going on, people protesting against the climate change policies of government. In a world where our leaders seem to be perfectly content to behave in ways which are not only a little bit inappropriate, but sometimes downright morally bankrupt. What do we do? Is Paul simply saying you just need to roll over and accept it? Just turn a blind eye. Having spent these last few weeks with this passage, I'm not convinced that Paul is advocating that kind of apathy. For a start, Paul is not talking about specific individual leaders, but about institutions, the structures of governance that are there to help maintain order. And that's really important because in terms of the question of what a Christian looks like, chaos doesn't feature very readily. Chaos does not feature very readily. And there is a very practical element to what Paul is talking about here as well, because he is talking to an audience of Christians in Rome in the first century. If you know the history, not always a very friendly place. Christians often viewed with suspicion, sometimes with outright hostility, and not necessarily guaranteed the same kind of civil protections that we would take for granted. In this way, Paul's words are intensely pragmatic. Do not poke the bear. Do not antagonize the people who are going to paint a very large target on your back, because when it came to insubordination, the Romans were ruthless. They crushed it every time. Because they were very well versed in that. They had a lot of practice, because rebellion, political rebellion, was actually a fairly common feature of the ancient world. It was not only frequent, it was frequently violent. If you go to your Gospels, you will encounter someone called Simon the Zealot, disciple of Jesus. He's so called because prior to being a disciple, he was a member of what was effectively a political terrorist group, a group called the Zealots, committed to violent resistance of the Roman occupation of Judea. And Jesus has very little to do with that. Despite the fact it's quite common, Jesus has virtually nothing to do with that kind of political resistance, which confuses a lot of people, arguably. People who are expecting the Messiah to be very active and very aggressive in the resistance of Roman occupation and destroying the enemies of Israel. But Jesus, if anything, is a little bit ambivalent about it. And the reason is because violence is not a hallmark of the gospel. Chaos and violence are just not hallmarks of the gospel. And Paul is very well aware of this. I think that's partly because both Jesus and Paul are aware that violence, firstly, it's not very practical. Violence, as cliched as it is, doesn't solve anything. Violence begets violence. We see this happening in the world today around us. If you go and look at something like radical extremism, jihadists who have resentment against Western political policies will often lash out violently, causing the West to then offer a robust response, which usually features sanctions, bombs, and even an invasion or two. And this just antagonizes jihadists further, and the cycle of violence continues, and it doesn't solve anything. Just continues the cycle of blood. Violence doesn't solve anything, but more to the point, it is a breeding ground for all those things which are the antithesis of the gospel. Bitterness, hatred, vengeance. Even violence, which has a seemingly very noble intent, can very quickly, very easily fall into that pitfall. And even if that violence comes and goes, it leaves behind a breeding ground of all those things that are the very enemy of the gospel. So that kind of violence is something Paul is very, very keen to warn us away from. But that doesn't mean that we need to be apathetic to injustice. Paul would be the first to say that it's not our job to be judge, jury, and executioner. That prerogative is God's to judge. And if we see someone in authority acting in a way which is ungodly, God will judge them and God will hold them to account. He may include us in that process, but that is not our job to go actively seeking out injustice, judging it, holding it to account. That is God's job. But that doesn't mean there's nothing that we can't do, that we don't have an answer. There is an answer, and Paul talks about it in verse 8. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. And then in verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor. Love is the answer to injustice. It is the prevention. It is also the cure. Because love changes things. And Paul goes even further. Love fulfills the law, which begs the question, what is love? How many of you automatically went, baby, don't hurt me after I said that? I was hoping someone would shout it out, actually. Not classic 90s dance tracks aside, what is the love Paul is talking about here? It's the word agape. Many of you will be familiar with that word. It's the word used across the New Testament to describe love. Its literal translation is charity. And the ancient Greeks called it the divine love, the love which was the most significant of every other type of love. Now, all love shares a common foundation. Love, if I were to describe it, a connection of affection that exists between two people, characterized by wanting good things for that person because you see worth in them. All love shares that foundation, but agape is different. Because whereas other loves, like our family loves, our friendships, romance, those are loves which are rooted in something very specific about the other person. Something about who they are in relation to us, or because of something we're attracted to, something we're drawn to about them. Agape is different. It is a love where we see worth in another simply because they are another person like us. A love which exists because the other person is there to be loved. And this means that it's a love which isn't rooted in some quality that person possesses or because of who the other person is. In fact, it often has to exist in spite of the other person. And this way, it is completely unconditional. It's not about how lovable the other person is. It's about how loving we are. It's not about what they mean to us. It's about what we can mean to them. And this makes it hugely important, but it also makes it very challenging, because it means it's not always mutual. It's not always accompanied by those warm and fuzzy feelings that we sometimes get when we experience love. It's not a love which is instinctive, or a love that we're drawn to or swept up in. It's a love we have to choose. We have to be very proactive about it, very deliberate. But don't get me wrong, I don't think that means that it's a love where we have to force ourselves to connect with someone. But I do believe it's about making a choice about ourselves. Choices about our attitudes, our mindset. Choices about how we see people and how we're going to respond. This is the love that fulfills the law, according to Paul. That means it's a love which accomplishes the things that the law asks of its people. And that law is, of course, the Jewish law, the law of Moses. And Andrew spoke about the law a few weeks ago and making it very clear that Paul doesn't think the law is bad. And that's an important point, because if you read Paul's letters, it can be very easy to get a bit confused by his approach to the law, because his language can be a little bit complicated, a little bit nuanced. But Paul thinks the law is good. What he's keen to do is make sure people are aware of the relationship that exists between the law and the gospel, understanding the law in light of the good news of Jesus Christ. Because when I look at those two things, I see a lot in common. Even though we tend to talk about them as two mutually exclusive things, I think there's a huge amount of common ground that they share, not least because both the law and the gospel were acts of grace. They were products of God's love for his people. If you go and read the story of the Israelites, you'll find that they enter into a covenant with God. It's a covenant that happens because God chooses them. When he lifts them out of bondage in Egypt, he does so because he has chosen them. In fact, he chooses them a long time before that. In the book of Deuteronomy, it says, God did not choose you because you were the most numerous people on earth, because you were actually the fewest. He chose you because he loved you, and he remembered the oath he swore to your ancestors. God chose the Israelites because he loved them, not because of something they'd done, not because of anything, any quality about them. He loved them. He chose them because he loved them. And he drew them close to himself and gave them the law so that they can live as his people, to maintain their closeness with him and to be his light to the nations. In this way, it's very, very similar to the gospel indeed. A gospel, a good news which tells us that God chooses us, that God draws us close to himself, equips us to maintain that closeness, and wants us to be a light to the nations of the world. The gospel and the law are very similar, but they do diverge in a very significant way. If you go back and read the law in the first five books of the Old Testament, you cannot fail to notice that it was extremely detailed. We are familiar with the Ten Commandments. There were actually 613 commandments that govern every aspect of their lives. Laws which govern the rites around sacrifice and about how they, for lack of a better expression, offset their sin. But then all these laws about how they interacted with each other. Laws about the type of fabric they use for their clothes. Laws against not eating badgers. Who was eating badgers? Every aspect of their life dictated what to do, when to do it. The word I like to use to describe it is prescriptive. It was prescriptive. And you know what? I think it had to be that way. It had to be that way because of who the Israelites were. Many of you will know that I have a son, Angus. You'll see him running around here like a nut sometimes. Don't get me wrong, we love that about him. One thing Angus has learned to do recently is sing happy birthday. It's lovely. We video it, and then we send it off to our friends and relatives as a nice birthday greeting. But we have to talk him through every step of that process. We have to tell him when to start singing. We have to tell him whose name to put into the song. We have to tell him which way to face. And more often than not, we have to tell him to stop. He doesn't have the awareness yet to be able to do any of that himself. He sings happy birthday, but I'm 100% sure he doesn't completely know what a birthday is just yet. He says a name, but quite a few times he doesn't really know who he's actually talking about. Sometimes he doesn't even know he's being filmed. One day he will, but now we have to talk him through it. And it was the same, I think, for the Israelites. When they entered into a covenant with God, it represented a seismic shift in their relationship. They had a closeness with God that they never had before. In fact, you could argue that prior to that, their relationship with God was a little bit shallow. They knew of their stories of the ancestors, they knew of God, but they didn't know him, at least not in the way that they were about to. Therefore, they didn't have a proper understanding of God's nature, his character, his heart, his plans, his priorities. In fact, no one even knew what his name was until Moses bothered to ask. So they didn't have the awareness to know how to live as his people. When it came to that question, they were a little bit clueless. And so God, in his grace, tells them how to. God tells them how to be his people, to do the things that God needs them to do, because they just don't know it. They don't know it. And Jesus says something in the New Testament which kind of alludes to this. It's an episode where he's talking about divorce. And someone asks him the question, and Jesus says, people really shouldn't be getting divorced unless there's been adultery. And this causes outrage, huge protest, because the law says they can. And they quote it to him accurately. And Jesus offers this response. Moses gave you that law because your hearts were hard. That law was appropriate then because of who you were. But things are going to change. People are going to change because Jesus changed everything. And one of the things Jesus did was show us the very heart of the law. He showed us the very founding principle of the law, which is to love God, love your neighbor as yourself. On this hang all the law and the prophets. And Jesus is able to show us this because he shows us the nature of the one who gave us the law. He shows us the Father in a way that had never been done before and has not been done since. He shows us, to quote the first letter of John, that God is love, and whoever lives in love lives in God. And I think that that truth is life-changing. And I don't say that as hyperbole or as kind of a whimsical sentiment, but as a hard fact. The fact that God is love and the fact that we can live in love, live in God, that changes us. If you take a mirror, obviously reflects things. The closer you hold it to the thing it's reflecting, the more of that image it will reflect. The more we love as God, Jesus has taught us to love, the more we embrace agape, the closer to God we become. The closer to God we are, the more we reflect him. The more we reflect his nature, the more we reflect love. And so we are changed, because our capacity to love grows. In this way, the gospel doesn't need to be prescriptive, because it's transformative. The law could be likened to a dot-to-dot drawing. You know those drawings you may have done as a child or perhaps as an artistically challenged adult? Where you have to form a picture by following the dots in numerical sequence. It requires no talent other than counting. But you still get a picture at the end of it, albeit a slightly wobbly, rough one maybe, but it gets the job done. If the law is a dot-to-dot drawing, the gospel transforms us into artists. The closer we are to God, the better we are able to hear him, hear his voice, to know his heart, and be inspired by that. Or, to put it in the words of the book of Jeremiah, God writes his law on our hearts. So, I asked a question at the start. What does a Christian look like? Well, they look like Jesus. Who was Jesus? Jesus was God, and God is love. Therefore, our life as a Christian is one of love. But that doesn't make it easy. Even if we share a very deep closeness with God, that doesn't mean that love becomes easy. I said earlier, it's an active love, a choice. And that remains true because we are flawed, and there will always be barriers and challenges that we need to face. Love requires time and energy, and those are precious commodities, and sometimes we don't have a lot of them. And actually, it's very easy to spend them elsewhere so that eventually we don't have enough to give to the people that need us. That's one example. Or maybe you're looking at this idea of complete unconditional love and it makes you a little bit wary. Can you really love the people who stand opposed to absolutely everything you believe in? Can you go out and care about the well-being of a jihadist or a white supremacist? Or maybe you're looking at that and worried about what other people are going to think if you do it. Can you imagine the flack you would get if you announced that you cared about the welfare of Harvey Weinstein? Our culture is convinced that to love someone is automatically to condone everything they stand for and everything they do, and it's just wrong. If it were true, God would not be able to love any of us. Or maybe you're a little bit like me, and actually your sense of self-worth is desperately low, and it becomes almost impossible to see worth in others. And if you can't see worth in them, then you can't love them. And so it becomes easier to tear people down to the level you think you're at than to build each other up to the level that God needs you to be. We always face challenges when it comes to love. I'm going to invite the band back up now. And we're going to have a time of reflection. And if you want to respond in that time, please do. I want to finish by saying this. I don't know the specifics of whatever challenges and barriers you face in your spiritual walk. I don't know what challenges you face when it comes to trying to love others as God wants them to be loved. But I do believe very firmly that we are not asked to face those challenges alone. God wants us to bring them to Him so that we can be changed by His love. But also want to encourage you to be open to the love of the people around you, either at home or in this community. Because that love can change us as well. Because every single one of us here, without fail, has the capacity to be a conduit of His grace and mercy. Amen.